Good afternoon. I'm Sharon Squassoni. I direct the Proliferation Prevention Program here at CSIS, and I'm very glad that you could join us this afternoon for Dr. David Wright speaking on North Korea's missile launch. As you are all aware, sort of surrounding the 100th birthday of Kim Il-sung, North Korea tested a ballistic missile. It was not successful. I think everyone is still sorting out the political implications, but we're here today to talk about some of the technical aspects of this. I have a few administrative notes. One is, please turn off your BlackBerries or your cell phones. They tend to do wonky things to our microphones. In the Q&A session, I'll probably remind you then, but we'd like you to introduce yourself. Some of us know each other, but not everyone does. I would like to give the, and this is all on the record, completely on the record. I'd like to give Karin Lee, the executive director of the National Committee on North Korea, a moment to talk about her program, because she was instrumental in bringing David right down here from Cambridge, but even initiating this program today. Karin?
I would like to say that David was very, very generous and brought himself down here. So so we're very grateful both to David and the Union of Concerned Scientists for jumping into this opportunity. He's been speaking all day on Capitol Hill and over at the State Department. It's been a great day. I've learned a lot. As I said to David, you know, I've gotten really behind on my email, because normally by the third meeting I've, you know, begun to tune the speaker out, and he's been so interesting, I haven't been able to do that. But I'm very grateful to Sharon and to CSIS for allowing us to have a public component of this meeting. A lot of the work NCNK does is off the record. It's great to have an on-the-record public meeting with David, and he'll answer as many of your questions as he can. So thanks to you all for coming, and thanks, Sharon, and to the Korea chair as well.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I will thank them later, but this is a joint, not only with the National Committee on North Korea, but also the Korea chair here at CSIS, and Victor Cha couldn't be with us today. But all the credit for organizing this goes to Marie Dumond, his assistant, who's done a terrific job. Let me just say, you have David's bio in front of you, but if you don't know him, you should. He's been one of the leading ballistic missile experts in the United States. Right now he's, or for a long time, you've been co-director of the Global Security Program at the Union of Concerned Scientists, located up in the Boston area. And he's the author of many publications, including the Physics of Space Security, yeah, which is great title for a piece. I guess this was right after I met you 20-something years ago. You went to UCS, but before that he was with the Federation of American Scientists and Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. So please, I'll give the floor to you, Dave.
Thank you. Fast.
15 to 20 minutes.
Okay. Well, it's very nice to be here. The one thing I wanted to point out on this first slide is a lot of the stuff that I've done recently on this is on our blog here, which we call allthingsnuclear.org. If you try to do www.allthingsnuclear.org, it won't get you there. So that's a good place to check back on sort of you know, things we're doing on this and other sorts of topics. I first started looking at North Korea's missile program in 1993, around the time of their Nodong launch, and do this sort of on the side to some extent, but every once in a while North Korea does something to make it relevant and interesting. So that's what happened this time, and I thought what it might be worth doing was just to try and not assume a lot of background of people here on missiles or the missile program, but to give you something of some background more generally, and then talk about how it related to the recent launch. So before this is a schematic of the launcher from 2009, very similar to the launcher that was used this time. But I want to take a step back and say what we think we know about North Korea's missile program is that in the late 1980s, they were able to get a hold of some Scud missiles from Russia. And there's an ongoing debate about whether they were able to reverse engineer and produce their version of that, or whether they continue to get components and put together Scud missiles. But that was sort of their early level of missiles that has about a 300-kilometer range, and so it's quite short range. As I said, in 1993, what got me interested was we saw them fire a longer-range missile, which is called the Nodong, at least in the West. That has a range of up to about 1,300 kilometers with a sort of nuclear level payload. But it's essentially just a scaled-up Scud missile. The engine is larger, the body is larger, but it uses the same fuels, it uses the same technology. And, in fact, we think that the engine of that missile is probably also Soviet origin. There are engines that were developed in the Soviet Union that are so similar to that the belief is that this was essentially an engine that was acquired from the Soviet Union. Now, the next step that we saw leading up to this is if you look back at the history of countries trying to develop longer range missiles, what they'll do is they'll take a working engine and they'll put, for example, what's called a cluster of four of them together. So now you've taken something you know works, you've used that as a component to get four times the thrust, and you've just added a much bigger fuel tank onto it. And that's what we think this large first stage is here, is basically it's two parts. It's a fuel and an oxidizer tank. They lead down to an engine, which is down here. And we think down there are the four engines. So, again, that's essentially Scud technology. That didn't surprise us so much to see that. What surprised us when we first saw pictures of the Unha-2 was the second stage. What I've shown here is when we went through and measured those and did a schematic drawing of it, what we found was that it was essentially identical in size to the Russian R-27 or the SSN-6 submarine launched missile. Now, the reason that's interesting is there have been continuing reports that in the early 90s that there were some number of these Soviet missiles transferred to North Korea, and again reports that North Korea may have sold some of those to Iran. We have not seen North Korea flight test that missile, which people have thought for a while they might. And the first time we saw its apparent appearance was when we saw this picture of the Unha-2. Now the question is, how do we know, or what makes us think that this is this Soviet missile, aside from its size? And the point is that we've done some fairly detailed computer modeling of these rockets. The one thing that's interesting about rockets is they have to obey the laws of physics. You know quite a bit about the technology of Scud missiles, so we knew quite a bit about how the first stage operated. And in the 2009 test, the first two stages operated essentially as North Korea said that they expected them to. And we know that because they announced splashdown zones where they expected those first two stages to splash down, and in fact the stages splashed down in those. So we believe that the first two stages worked essentially as they intended. And if you then ask, could you get the second stage to work using Scud technology, the answer is no. Our computer models show that it just did not have enough capability. And if we ask what capability that stage would have needed, it's essentially the same capabilities as the Soviet R-27. That's a next-generation set of propellants. Instead of being made out of a steel casing, we believe it's made out of a lightweight aluminum alloy casing. All these things that we know about, for historical reasons, about the Soviet missile. So one of the questions is, did North Korea get actual missiles? Did they get plans for these missiles? Did they get production equipment? And the answer is we don't really know. But we do have the following clue, which is North Korea had never launched a missile like this before, like this second stage. It's, as I said, a generation in structure and in propellant beyond what they had any experience with. And yet they were confident enough to launch it, and in the launch it appeared to work. That suggests to us that it was actually a piece of equipment that they got from the Soviet Union and had been previously tested. So it's, again, not definitive, but it's certainly suggestive. The third stage up here is very similar to, and possibly, oh, before I go on, I forgot I had an insert here. This is from pictures of Iran, and I don't know how well you can see it, but it actually shows a cluster of four of these Nodong engines. You can see there's something here that's almost an hourglass shape, comes down. This is the nozzle. So there's one here, there's one over here, one there, and one behind it. So again, just to give you an idea of what this sense of clustering engines looks like, this is what we expect the inside of this to look like. And Iran showed this off sometime last year as something that they're working on for their next larger launcher. I was talking about the third stage. We believe the third stage is identical or very close to identical to the second stage and the upper stage of the Iranian launcher that put Iran's first satellite into space. We think that that stage uses the small engines off of this Soviet R-27 missile. The R-27 has a large main engine and then has these two smaller engines that are used for steering. And what we believe, both from having seen pictures of this stage and also its performance, is that what they essentially did was took these small steering engines and used those to power that third stage. Now, that's not the kind of thing you would do if you were going to put a nuclear warhead on a missile like this, because they're not that powerful. But in this case, they were trying to get a very lightweight satellite into space. And for that, it's actually works pretty well. If you compare it here to the Iranian launcher, this first stage of the Iranian launcher is essentially a Nodong, or the Iranian version of that is a Shahab 3. And this configuration is similar to what North Korea launched in 1998, their first satellite launch, which failed after two stages. Now, you can ask the question, do you expect that a configuration like this would, in principle, be able to put a satellite in orbit? And I think the answer is yes. Our models show that this would be able to get you to the right altitude with essentially the right speed. So I think there's no particular reason why this would not be able to put a satellite in orbit. I also think that the launch, both in 2006 and this time, was in fact an attempt to put a satellite in orbit. People ask me, was it a missile launch? Was it a satellite launch? I believe it was a satellite launch. But on the other hand, if it had been successful, North Korea would still learn about the rocket technology that it could then use for a ballistic missile. And in fact, if you took the first two stages of this, which, as I said, worked apparently as intended in 2009, and put a nuclear warhead on top of those, you could probably get a range of about 8,000 kilometers out of that. So that's a little shorter than North Korea might want, but it's still, and it tells you that it would have a relatively long range. Now, So what I was just describing was the Unha 2 from 2009. This shows a side-by-side pictures of the 2009 launcher and the 2012 launcher. And the point here is the red lines essentially show you where the stages are, and you can convince yourself by looking at this that they really are essentially the same missile. Now, that's what we would have expected, because we haven't seen North Korea developing other sorts of technology that we would have expected they would have used, so it's not at all surprising to find this. If you looked at the upper stage in more detail than this, the one thing that struck us was that the upper stage appeared to be slightly longer. And we expected that for the following reason. These are the paths that the launchers followed in 2009 and 2003. So the 2009 launch went essentially due east. That carried it over the northern part of Japan, which is one of the things that caused a lot of the political issues at the time. So instead, this time, they fired south. This is essentially, and I'll come back to this because I think it's an interesting comparison, this trajectory is essentially the trajectory that South Korea uses when it launches its satellite launches, and for the same reason. Both of them are constrained by the geography of the region, and if they don't want to fly over land masses early on, they're essentially forced to fly south. Now, why would you want to fly east in the first place? The reason is that the Earth rotates to the east. And that means if you launch a satellite launcher and you shoot east, you actually pick up some of the speed from the rotation of the Earth. So the speed you need to put something in orbit is actually from the speed you need from the rocket to put something in orbit is actually somewhat less than if you fly south. So since they were flying south this time, we knew that they had to do something to gain that extra speed they were not getting from the rotation of the Earth. And that led us to believe, even before we saw the missile, that the upper stage would contain more fuel. Now, once the upper stage contains more fuel, that means it's heavier. That's going to slow down the lower two stages. And, in fact, even before the launch, I was able to do this simulation. The red case here was the 2009 launch. And these two bars here and here were the pre-announced areas where North Korea said that their first two stages would fall into the water, and in fact they did. And when they announced the splashdown zones for this launch, it was this blue in here and the blue in here. So the first thing you notice is that they're moved back toward the launch site. Well, that's partly so they could miss the Philippines, because you can see if they had kept to something longer, they would have flown into the Philippines. But when I added the additional fuel to the top of this launcher to make up for the fact that it's not going with the rotation of the Earth, that actually slowed down the first two stages enough that, in fact, they fell into these regions. So, again, there was a certain consistency here that made it sound like this was a very plausible, from an engineering point of view, a very plausible thing that they had thought through, that they seemed to know what they were doing, and made us think that it really was an attempt to put a satellite in orbit. For people who aren't used to looking at these things, the reason this looks like this, if you follow this blue curve up, for example, the first stage ignites, it burns for about 2 minutes, and then it stops burning. It then drops off. And so this first stage then will lose speed and fall into the ocean. But the second stage at that point is burning. It burns for about 2 minutes, and it gets up a little ways, then it runs out of fuel, and it drops off. Now it has enough speed that it actually keeps going like this and falls down here. And then the third stage keeps burning and puts the satellite into orbit. So that's what these dotted lines are. Those are the trajectories of the empty stages as they fall to Earth. The other question that people have asked is, can you really tell the difference between a satellite launch and an ICBM launch? And the answer is you can in two ways. One is from the shape of the trajectory, and the other is from the length of time that the engines of the rocket burn. So if you look at the red line here, which is a typical liquid-fueled ICBM launch, you can see that it burns out relatively quickly. You want to have a fairly short burn time, get the warhead up to speed, and then let it go and let it essentially fall through space. And you can see it keeps gaining altitude at that point because you're trying to make it go as far as possible. On the other hand, if you're trying, for example, in this case, they were trying to get a satellite up to about 500 kilometers. So what you do is you try to get it up to 500 kilometers, but you then flatten out the trajectory and continue burning to get the speed up to orbital speed. And so not only does it flatten out at 500 kilometers, but the third stage burns for much longer. So you'll see that the UNHA didn't burn out and the engines didn't burn out until over here, where a typical ICBM would burn out much closer to the launch site. So the answer is we can tell the difference. From what we could tell of the trajectory in 2009, it was consistent with a satellite launch and not an ICBM launch. We didn't have much time to see it this time, but people tell me it also looked like it was the beginning of a satellite launch trajectory. Again, not a big surprise. So the question is, what happened? And the answer is, We don't really know yet. Information is still sort of leaking out, but here's what we think happened. Shortly after the launch, U.S. NORAD and U.S. Northern Command came out with a statement saying that the rocket had failed and had fallen into the Yellow Sea, and the number they gave was 165 kilometers from Seoul. Some other information came out, for example, that the rocket had gone up to 120 kilometers and that it had coasted for about 7 minutes after it failed before it landed. And if you put all those together, then they sort of get you to a scenario that says that the launch point was here, the rocket burned for about 100 seconds, something happened at that point, the thrust stopped, and that would carry it to a point just about here. Now, again, there may be information that comes out later that says, you know, some of those numbers are not right, but that appears to be roughly what happened. There are reports of an explosion of the rocket. One possibility is that North Korea lost control of the rocket, that it was starting to veer off course. It's a little hard to tell whether the fact that it's well off of its intended course here is just because the information isn't good, or whether it actually was starting to veer off its intended course, at which point, since it was a liquid rocket, North Korea could actually shut down the engines, and it's typical to put a self-destruct mechanism so that large pieces don't come down. We don't know whether that's what happened, or the other possibility is people have talked about flashes seen coming from the back of the rocket, which suggests there may have been a fuel leak or something like that, which could have caused the explosion. So we don't really know. It appears that it failed during the first stage, when the first stage was burning, which means that North Korea didn't get some of the information that it would like. For example, one of the most complicated parts of a launch is when the staging occurs, because you have to ignite the next stage and then release the previous stage in a controlled way, and so they would have clearly liked to have gotten through that process to see if it was working well, and they didn't get that information. The other thing we don't know, because we don't know that much about North Korea, is that it's typical, for example, the United States sends telemetry back. So every second that the rocket is burning, it's monitoring all of the subsystems, and it's sending information back to tell, you know, how they're operating, what the status is. So that if the missile fails at any point, you know exactly what was happening right up to that point. It's a little like the black box on an aircraft. We don't know whether North Korea was monitoring to that detail. And if they weren't, then it means they may have very little information about what actually happened on board. If you look at this red triangle down here, was the pre-announced splashdown zone for the first stage. And again, if the splashdown was up here, that's part of what makes us think that it was a failure during first stage, and again, that it was fairly early on. It's interesting, as I said before, to compare sort of the flight paths of launches by North and South Korea. And so here, the white path is the path that the North Korean launch was supposed to follow. The yellow path is the path of two recent South Korean flights. South Korea, you may know, has satellites in orbit, but those have all been launched by other countries. A few years ago, North Korea decided to develop its own launch capabilities, and it's done two attempts to launch its own satellites, one in 2009, one in 2010, and they both failed. The first stage of North Korea's launcher was built by Russia, so it's a country that knows how to build missile stages. Second stage was indigenous South Korean, again, a very highly advanced technical country. And the reason I bring that up is there have been a lot of people sort of saying, well, this shows that North Korea doesn't know what they're doing. And the point is, it's a very hard thing to do. I mean, if you look at the outside of a missile, it looks very simple. But inside are a lot of subsystems that have to do with, you know, the pumps for getting fuel to the engines. There's the sensors that can tell the acceleration and whether or not you're getting off axis. There's the control that goes back to guide the system. There's all these subsystems. Any one of those failing can cause the system to fail. And so they all have to work together. And the fact that, you know, South Korea has tried twice and has also run into problems, I think, is an indication that it is an intrinsically difficult thing to do. And it also, I think, makes the argument that some people have argued that, well, North Korea doesn't care as much about reliability as the United States, and so even if it hasn't flight-tested missiles, it may consider them, you know, operational and deploy them. Missiles are just too complicated to do that. You can't assume that if you put a missile out there without flight testing that it's going to work. The other thing that was interesting, I thought, the reaction of the countries in the area to the North Korean launch was that there was a lot of concern about North Korea, you know, dumping debris on the neighboring countries. And it turns out in South Korea's first flight that it actually did dump debris on Australia. And again, that's one of the things that happens when you're trying to do space flights. It was interesting to see the fact that people tended not to think of that as a risk with other tests, but they did with North Korea. So the implications for the program are, as I said, I think that the basic missile design, the basic launcher design that North Korea has, looks like something that should be able to put a satellite into orbit if they could get it to work. It's intrinsically hard to get all the subsystems of a launcher to work at the same time to actually get something into space. So it doesn't mean that they don't know what they're doing, but the fact that they have not had a successful test of anything longer than essentially a 1,300-kilometer range missile does put some limits on what the capability of their program are and how fast they can move forward. And the other thing with North Korea is we don't see them launch very fast. We have not seen sort of a systematic approach to developing missiles of the type we've seen, for example, in Iran. Iran did a number of early flight tests. They then had a satellite launch that worked. They then used that same launcher to launch additional satellites. So we've seen them sort of systematically working their way up through a program in a way that you would expect to see. North Korea's program has been much more sort of hit and miss. And again, it calls into question either how serious they are at developing a real missile program, or it may be an indication that they are constrained by the components that they've been able to get from other countries and therefore are not able to do very many launches. And I just want to finish with a couple comments about some other missiles. These are from the parade that happened, I think, 2 days after the launch. This is the so-called Musadon missile. This was actually seen a year before this past parade. And these are believed to essentially be Soviet SSN-6 missiles, only elongated. People have long expected that if North Korea was able to get some number of Soviet SSN-6 missiles, that it would do a flight test. They have a range of about 3,000 kilometers. It would therefore give them, you know, sort of an intermediate range capability. But they have never been flight tested. The only time we've seen a flight of one of these rockets appears to be the second stage of the Yunha-2. So then the question is, if they flew it on the Yunha-2, does that count as a flight test for the Musadon? And the answer is it doesn't, for a couple reasons. One is that the plan, at least according to this, appears to have taken the SSN-6 missile, to have extended the fuel tanks by about 2.5 meters, which adds about 400 kilograms onto it. So you've now completely changed the aerodynamics and the weight distribution of this missile. And it's also very different if you're trying to launch a missile from the ground through the heavy part of the atmosphere. The atmospheric forces on the missile are very different than if you second stage where you essentially light off above the atmosphere. So my point is, this is the second time we've seen this. People who have looked carefully at some of the high-resolution photographs believe these are mock-ups. But when you hear people say that North Korea has deployed Musadon missiles, I don't believe it. We've never seen a flight test of one of these, and I just don't believe there's any sense in which it can be considered operational. And finally, we come to this new missile that was seen at the parade. Here it is sitting on this eight-axle trailer. There has now been, let's see which of these is a better picture. there are two German missile engineers who have now gone through all the photographs of this from the parade. And one of the real benefits of having North Korea invite in reporters is that there have been some really great high-resolution photographs of this. North Korea paraded six of these in the parade. If you look at those six very carefully, it turns out that all six are slightly different. They differ in odd ways. You'll see these these things running down are channels that carry essentially cables from the top to the bottom of a stage. Those cables go into the stages at different places on the different missiles. If you look at where these bands are, which appear to be places that you would expect to see staging, those bands are at slightly different places. If you look at the placement of where these cables go into the stages, it's the kind of thing you would expect from a solid-fueled missile. And yet, whoever made these mock-ups also put on the sides fuel ports where you would add liquid fuel to this. And so as a friend of mine said, this looks like a mock-up that somebody who really knew airplanes well would have made of a missile. I mean, I think there's just very little doubt that what was seen out there were not real missiles. They were mock-ups. The question is whether there's something in development that looks like this or whether this is just a figment of somebody's imagination. There are peculiar things. If North Korea is developing a missile like this, there are some peculiar things about it. For example, if you look at the relative size of the second stage to the first stage, it seems to be well off optimal. I mean, if you look at the size of the third stage and its diameter compared to the rest of the missile, it doesn't look like the kind of thing you would do if you were really trying to develop a missile. So I can't say for sure, but this looks to me like something that does not represent a real missile in development. What has become more interesting about this is if you look at the truck that it's being operated on, and you compare that to a picture of a truck that is sold for commercial purposes in China, you can start to convince yourself that these have more than a passing resemblance to one another. I mean, even down to these reflective marks here and the steps here, and if you look at the tank back here, I mean, it's actually pretty clear it's the same truck. And so now you ask yourself, so what's going on here? And the answer is we don't really know. We don't know whether whether China sold North Korea trucks that are dual purpose, that can be used for logging purposes, to haul around construction equipment. I mean, these trucks like this have commercial uses. And then added on this trailer and what looks like a mock-up of an erector for a missile. If that's the case, then maybe it was, maybe it was an honest mistake that somebody sold this either to a front company or something like that. On the other hand, if China sold a truck like this to North Korea knowing that it was going to be used for hauling missiles around, then that's certainly problematic. On the other hand, if China knew that, in fact, North Korea did not have a real missile that would fit on a truck like this, then is it sanctionable to sell a truck that can be used to parade around a fake missile? I mean, there's a lot of tricky questions here, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know the answer to them. But I think this is going to be played out over the next few weeks. The only other thing that I would mention, just going back to this, is people were expecting to see an ICBM. Everybody talked about this North Korean ICBM. And so the question is there any way in which this is an ICBM? And the answer, I think, is pretty clear that it's not. A missile, this is only about 18 meters long. It's about 2 meters in diameter. So it's not a very large missile. It's possible if that were solid fuel that you could conceivably get an intercontinental range out of that. But North Korea doesn't know how to make large solid-fueled engines. The largest solid-fueled missile we've seen them launch is essentially a Soviet SS-21 missile, which has a range of about 100 kilometers. It's much smaller diameter than anything you'd have here. And we know that when China was trying to develop the DF-31 and the DF-31A, that it took them a couple decades to develop the technology to make these large solid engines. There are technical reasons why it's very difficult to do that, and as you get to bigger solid engines, it gets more and more difficult. So I don't think there's any reason to believe that this is solid-fueled. And if you believed it was a real rocket and you believed it was liquid fuel, I have not yet done, you know, calculations on what the range would be given the fuel capacity, but my guess is it's probably something like, you know, 2,500 to 3,000 kilometers. So it's certainly not an ICBM, even if it were a real missile. And the last thing I just wanted to comment on, because there's a lot of confusion about this, is people have talked about mobile missiles, that North Korea has a mobile ICBM. And I wanted to make the distinction between a mobile missile and a movable missile. And that sounds like, being clever with words, but it's actually not. When people talk about a mobile missile, what that typically means is you have something that, you know, that looks like this, only you could move it someplace, you could erect it very quickly, and within 10 to 15 minutes you could fire it off. And that's typically what you would have with, for example, short-range battlefield rockets that are solid-fueled. You can move them up someplace, all the fuel's in them, you erect them and you shoot them off. It's the kind of capability that China has now developed with its DF-31. But if you have a liquid-fueled missile, you can't do that. And the reason is that if you have a liquid-fueled missile, the sides of that, the structure has to be very lightweight in order to be able to for that missile to have a long range. And if you tried to fill that with 50 tons of propellant and then put it on its side and drive it on a road and shake it around and then lift it up and try and erect it, you simply can't do it. And so what you would do instead is you would transport the body on a launcher without the fuel in it, and then you do here what we see with the Chinese DF-3s. The DF-3 is about the same size, roughly, as the first stage of the Yunha, or the first stage of the Taepodong 2. And you can't see it very well here, but there's sort of a trailer that sticks out behind here. So they've carried this thing empty on a trailer. It doesn't take much of a trailer to do that. You then erect it, and then you have all of these tank trucks that come in to fill it with fuel once it's erected. Now, that gives you the advantage of not being tied to a given launch site, so you can move the missile around. But once you get to that launch site, it's going to take you a couple hours to set this thing up, to get the fuel tanks there, to get the fuel in it before you can launch it. And so while it may give you the ability of not being tied to a given launch site, it certainly adds in a considerable vulnerability during this time that you're filling the missile. From what I've been able to tell in talking to people, the reports of a North Korean mobile missile are based on the fact that U.S. intelligence has seen large trailers and large trucks in North Korea. I would argue that that's consistent with a movable missile, not a mobile missile, and that that's probably what's going on here, just like China did back in the 1970s with the DF-3 and the DF-4. So it's not like a breakthrough of technology. It doesn't indicate that there's a brand new missile. It sounds to me like they're talking about moving the missiles that they have around from place to place so they're not tied to a launch site. And why don't I just stop at that point?
Okay.